More than 100 million people will tune in to tonight's Super Bowl. Packers fans, Steelers fans, the fans of million-dollar commercials. And many of those people will dress for the occasion, some with a terrible towel, some with a foam cheese head. Many others will wear more traditional adornments, NFL jerseys. As NPR's Nathan Rott reports, you might be surprised to learn how many of those jerseys are fakes.
In the realm of sports fandom, there are football fans and there are Tonys.
It's not a game. You feel like it's do or die almost. You know, it's life.
Tony Song isn't just a Steelers fan. He is a Steelers fan addict.
I mean, if they lose, this next week's not going to be good, you know. Clinical depression is possible.
Safe to say, Tony likes his Steelers. Of course, you'd probably gather as much looking at the Steelers hat, Steelers tennis shoes, and Steelers jersey he's wearing when he meets me in Rockville, Maryland. He's got a plastic garbage bag with him. I ask what's inside.
I'm going to show you all. I brought 7 jerseys, including what I'm wearing. There's like 10 more in my room that I just, you know, it's too much to bring. It gets heavy. I'm just going to take this apart.
See, Tony doesn't just love the game. He loves the gear. He owns some 25 sports jerseys, 15 of which are Steelers, and in total they've cost him anywhere from $2,000 to $2,500. Seem like a lot? That's because they're all legit, bought from official NFL retailers at or near full price. Otherwise, he says, they'd probably be fake.
There's probably 500,000 fake jerseys floating on eBay right now. So if you ever want to buy a real jersey, you can't buy one on eBay or Craigslist or any of these ads.
And the experts say he's right. A recent report by Mark Monitor, a brand protection company, found more than 1,300 websites selling nothing but questionable sports gear. Those sites attract over 56 million visits and sell an estimated 800,000 counterfeit jerseys each year. For major sports brands, that means tens of millions of dollars in lost revenue. It also means counterfeiting sports jerseys is a lucrative business, says Fred Fellman, Mark Monitor CMO.
We found that these are very profitable sites.
So profitable that they're able to pay for advertising and spread across international borders, making them harder to shut down by the sports brands they're stealing from, or to be stopped by internet service providers, ISPs, and from law enforcement agencies as well.
In one instance where we've purchased goods, we found that the ISP was U.S., the phone number was listed in the U.S., but the people answering the phone were Russian. The credit card that we gave them was processed in Israel, and the goods were shipped from somewhere in Asia.
Of course, some people might not care that their jersey is fake or shipped from Asia. It may fall apart or bleed in the wash, but hey, if it costs half the price, but it's not that simple. Buying from a counterfeiter can lead to identity theft, Fellman says. And besides,
the material is crappy. It doesn't look as good. You know, you get what you pay for, right? That's what they say.
And Tony would know. Nathan Rott, NPR News, Washington.
We're on a quest to find one winner with the right blend of 600 words. We've received nearly 4,000 short stories in this round of our 3-Minute Fiction Contest on Weekend All Things Considered. Here's what Alexander Felix of Great Neck, New York, and Laurie Anderson of Lubbock, Texas, have demonstrated. Sometimes telling a great story only takes 3 minutes.
"Will you remember me tomorrow?" he asks. "Yes, of course," you say. He searches for the words in his head, blinks, continues. "Will you remember me in a week?" You stare back at him. He knows. How does he know? "Of course I will," you say. "Don't be silly." Knock, knock, he interrupts. "Who's there?" He laughs. "Mama, you forgot me already." A few seconds pass, and he's still smiling, satisfied with the joke. You want to laugh. Tell him you can't wait to tell Daddy the joke tomorrow over breakfast. He'll love it. Really, it was that good. But you say nothing. Instead, you pull him by the front of his pajamas, thrust your face into his small chest as if he were a tissue. When he hears you whimper, he thinks you're laughing.
"I cough. I try to swallow. I vow to stay silent. But I keep thinking about all the times my brother came home late, or not at all. My father's brow stitched with worry. My mother crying in the bathroom where she thought I couldn't hear. I think of that night, the late ringing phone, the three of us shuffling in the dark, the coat I put on inside out. All those lights made the unfamiliar street seem almost foreign, the reds and blues casting everyone as garish characters, puppets in a show. By the time we arrived, the ambulance had already carried the woman away. We surveyed the damage. My father, running his hands through his hair. My mother, shredding a Kleenex into shaggy bits that rested on the grass at her feet.
Excerpts from the story A Saint and a Criminal by Laurie Anderson, read by Bob Mondello, and Departure by Alexandra Felix, read by Lynn Neary. To read the full content of these stories, go to our website, nbr.org/3MinuteFiction. That's 3 Minute Fiction, all spelled out, no spaces. And you can also follow us on our 3 Minute Fiction Facebook page.
Next, we go to Chicago for a story on what you could call snow futures. They are financial contracts based on the level of snowfall. Companies trade them in the hopes of softening the blow that a big blizzard might have on their business. Here's Nyla Boodoo of Midwest Reporting Project Changing Gears.
The old-fashioned way to deal with record snowfall usually involves shovels, plows, or snowblowers. But former Merrill Lynch trader Jeff Hodgson had another idea.
Wow, this is a storm that I didn't foresee coming, and I just lost a lot of money on my business, or maybe I could have made more money.
That's right. His idea was to create a hedging business for snowstorms. So Hodgson started the Chicago Weather Brokerage in 2009 to help connect companies that want to hedge their bets on how the weather affects their bottom line. He did this by helping the CME Group create a financial market based on snowfall. They're actually called snow derivatives. So here's how it works. The average snowfall for winter in Chicago is around 37 inches. So the contracts are like insurance, paying out a set amount of money for every inch over or under, depending on what kind of contract you take out.
Everybody kind of says, well, you can control everything but the weather.
That's the Chicago Mercantile's Tim Andreessen.
Well, we can't control the weather, but we can help you mitigate the risk of the weather on your business.
These snow contracts are based on official airport snowfall tallies at Chicago's O'Hare, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Detroit, and Boston, as well as New York's LaGuardia and in Central Park. Andreessen says contract holders range from road salt manufacturers and property managers to snow removal contractors and airlines.
Our products would allow people to hedge against that extra cost of having to deal with the weather.
The snow contracts trade until March. Then the Chicago Weather Brokerage shifts to its newest market, hedging rainfall. For NPR News, I'm Nyla Boodoo in Chicago.
Some of what we know about the inner workings of the Egyptian government come from the recent release of American diplomatic cables by WikiLeaks. And some college professors are now using WikiLeaks cables in the classroom. But as NPR's Jessica Diehl reports, there's a debate within the academic community about whether that is ethical.
We're in a classroom at one of the country's premier policy schools. It's called SAIS, the School of Advanced International Studies, part of Johns Hopkins University in Washington. Students here will go on to work in the State Department and in embassies around the world, but first, they have to learn the fundamentals of how U.S. foreign policy is made. And following the release of thousands of classified diplomatic cables through the website WikiLeaks, the professor in this classroom has some new teaching materials.
I thought it was a positive thing, quite frankly. I'm very glad that Assange has published these documents, has made available these documents.
That's Professor Piero Gliesis. He's referring to Julian Assange, the man behind WikiLeaks. Gliesis says he has no reservations about using these secret cables in his classroom. As raw documents from contemporary diplomats, he believes they offer the kind of insight that no book or article could provide.
Obviously, they're extremely valuable. Extremely valuable.
He already has one cable he's thinking about using in his class. It's written by a U.S. diplomat in Mexico. It expresses concern that Venezuela and Cuba are using goodwill programs in Mexico to spread anti-U.S. propaganda. Gliesis says he could use it to illustrate the assumptions that exist behind U.S. policy.
And then a thinking student might ask himself whether our hatred for Cuba or our dislike for Venezuela justifies such concerns, and what should be the policy, etc., etc.
So that's the content of the cables, but their structure could be considered useful too. Here's Ambassador Mark Grossman. He teaches across town at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service.
In India, apparently, they're showing their own diplomats the cables to say, this is what we want. We want, you know, kind of this shape and this size, you know, very interesting.
Grossman says these cables could give aspiring diplomats cues on effective writing style, length, tone. And on top of all this, he thinks the cables could be a great recruiting tool for the State Department, where he worked for almost 3 decades. The cables give glimpses into the life of a U.S. diplomat, prepping the Secretary of State for a meeting with the King of Saudi Arabia, reporting from a lavish wedding ceremony in the former Soviet Union, assessing corruption high up the ranks in the Afghan government.
There are probably people out there who will look at these and say, gosh, I'd like to be a diplomat. I'd like to be a Foreign Service officer. I'd like to be part of something that interesting and that good.
Despite all of these reasons to use them, Ambassador Grossman will not be bringing the cables into his classroom.
I feel morally obligated not to. They're stolen documents as far as I'm concerned.
He understands why they're enticing, but he worries that by asking students who want to be diplomats to read stolen, classified cables, he could be hurting their future job prospects.
I have to be careful in my class about not putting those people into any jeopardy. They need their security clearances. They want to have their careers.
But the State Department has not yet issued any authoritative instructions to those who are not current employees. And the schools where the professors teach are taking a hands-off approach. They're considering the use of the cables in the classroom an academic freedom issue. And they're letting the instructors decide what's best for them and their students. Jessica Diehl, NPR News, Washington.
Now, if you've got a bucket of wings on your Super Bowl menu, you might want to think about this. Wings are white meat. The average American shopper almost always goes for white meat. We see white meat as healthier and tastier than dark. Notice how McDonald's brags that its chicken McNuggets are white meat. But what happens to all those unloved legs and thighs? Well, until recently, we've sent them overseas, mostly to Russia. But now Russia wants to wean itself off imported American chicken and boost its own poultry business. That leaves American producers with a dilemma. What to do with the back half of that chicken? Nadia Arumugam is a food writer in New York City. I asked her why American shoppers turn up their noses at dark meat.
I think there are a number of different reasons on a number of different levels. I think if you'd ask a shopper, they'd rationalize this aversion, and they'd probably say that thighs or drumsticks don't taste good, it's unhealthy, it's fatty. But I think there are also a lot of reasons that people aren't necessarily conscious of, that they're subliminal. And one of these, I would say, is that people don't like to be reminded that when they eat meat, it's actually part of an animal. And when you have a chicken leg in front of you, there's no denying that that's an animal limb.
Well, what is it that makes dark meat dark?
It's a chemical compound called myoglobin. And there's nothing scary about it. There's nothing dangerous about it. All it is myoglobin is a chemical compound that helps oxygen reach muscles. And if you think about a chicken, it spends most of its life on its legs. And therefore, those legs are working and moving. And so those muscles will have a lot of myoglobin, and that's why the meat is dark. Whereas a breast on a chicken, because a chicken doesn't fly, those breasts aren't being moved very much and they're sort of relaxed. And so there's a lack of myoglobin, hence why the meat is pretty fair in color.
Now, Is dark meat really that much fatter?
Well, you know, I mean, there is a little bit more fat, but it really is marginal. I think this is well-publicized claim that breast meat is much healthier for you. And I really think to some degree that's erroneous. You know, when you have skinless, well-trimmed dark meat, it's incredibly healthful. And when you look at data that's published by the USDA on their own website.
That's the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Exactly. When it comes to fat and calories, there's actually very little to distinguish between skinless chicken breasts and skinless thighs. The breasts have 114 calories. The thighs have 119, which basically means that if you did a couple of sit-ups, you'd burn off those extra calories. And again, it's similar in terms of fat. There really isn't much difference in it. And when it comes to nutrients, personally, I think dark meat really wins hands down. It has higher levels of iron. It has higher levels of zinc, thiamine, riboflavin, and vitamin B. So you're really getting a good nutritional boost with dark meat.
I assume that dark meat is your personal preference because you're giving it a good rep here.
It is. I hope I didn't make that too obvious. I'm Malaysian myself, and so I really grew up on dark meat. And in our house, when we were young, we would always fight for the chicken legs, and the breasts would always sit there looking sad and paltry.
Now, if we have perhaps convinced some people to try a little bit of dark meat next time, do you have a favorite recipe?
I do. Personally, you know, I love to stir fry with dark chicken meat, with boneless, skinless chicken thighs. And it's really no different than cooking with boneless, skinless chicken breasts. You know, you cut it up into bite-sized pieces. But the real advantage is that it really stays really nice and moist. So what I do is I just cut it up into bite-sized pieces. I'll season it with some soy sauce, some ginger, some crushed garlic, a bit of sesame oil maybe, and then stir-fry that up with, you know, lots of fresh vegetables. And it's so quick, and I think it's very user-friendly and very accessible. And it's a great starting point for someone who wants to start cooking with dark meat.
Check out our website, NPR.org, for a copy of Nadia Arumugam's recipe. Nadia Arumugam is a food writer. She's based in New York City. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Linda. It was great to talk to you.
AOL announced early this morning that it is buying the Huffington Post for $315 million. The deal brings together an internet company that's been struggling with a news website that's been growing rapidly and creating buzz since its founding in 2005. Under the terms, Arianna Huffington, who is the co-founder of Huffington Post, will be in charge of AOL content. And for more, we've reached Kara Swisher in San Francisco. She's written two books about AOL. Good morning.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thank you. Well, why is AOL doing this deal with Huffington Post for this price at this time?
Well, the price is one issue, but they're doing it because they need to really turbocharge this effort by the CEO, Tim Armstrong, to focus on content and sort of become, they're calling it a new media company. And sort of a new media, and not in the old media way, but sort of a way to deliver content and quality content in a web fashion and actually make money from it.
And what do we know about Arianna Huffington's new role? I mean, she's been running Huffington Post basically out of her home, but that won't be the case anymore.
New York. I mean, she has a lovely office in Los Angeles, but they have a large office with 200 employees in New York City.
Right. So about her new role with AOL.
She'll be the head of all the content on AOL, and they own a lot of content properties across a lot of topic areas. They've got finance sites. They've got politics sites. She's even running the MapQuest division of AOL.
And one thing about content, the Huffington Post is very much identified as a liberal outpost.
Mm-hmm.
Is this how AOL wants to be identified?
Well, it's going to be brought up because Arianna's she's sort of a lightning rod in so many ways, for both good and bad, depending on what side you're on. But she's actually been leaning against, if you've noticed lately, she's sort of been on the attack against the Obama administration of late. You never know quite where she's going to go. So even though it started out as sort of a counter to the Drudge Report, which was the right-leaning website, I think it's sort of evolved into a more central kind of thing where there's a lot of debate going on. And she's certainly sort of in the Democratic camp, but at the same time, they've really evolved and broadened their topic areas beyond politics, too.
Well, this merger, what do you think it says about the future of online news? And there you get into, maybe you could, you know, answer if this is a good deal for AOL for what it's offering to pay.
Well, you know, Huffington Post has been growing its revenue. So, you know, if they get to where they say they were going to get this next year, it would be about 5 times the revenue, and it's 10 times the revenue from last year. It's a good deal in that it gives them the Huffington Post is very good at creating a very exciting aggregation play in news, and they also have started to do original journalism on the site. They were dinged a lot for not doing enough of that. And so it gives, you know, it's really very good at aggregating a fun and exciting read on the Internet. The the question is, how are people reading now? Are young people reading more socially? Do they read at websites? Do they go to destinations? What it does say is that news is an exciting area, and it always will be. It just depends on how it's going to be distributed.
Kara, thanks very much.
No problem.
Kara Swisher is co-executive editor of All Things Digital, a tech and media blog owned by Dow Jones.